Welcome to Winning the Game of Life. Known as Jungle Man at the poker table, Dan Cates has gone from being the bag boy at McDonald's with no friends and a dead-end future to winning over $11 million in online poker, over $7 million in live tournaments, and is a World Series of Poker champion. He has found fame, fortune, been to incredible places all over the globe, and connected with some amazing people. It looks like Dan has won the game of life, but that is not the way he sees it. Dan sees winning as doing his part to help everyone in the world win. He knows he can't do it alone, though. He knows it's going to take a collective effort with anyone that wants to see the same thing. Join us each week as Dan starts the conversation to do just that. On the show, Dan will interview incredible individuals that have made the impossible possible. Those that have won the game of life, and those that want to help others win as well. Hit subscribe and follow Dan's journey on Instagram at TheDanCates. Let's explore anyone and anything that can help make this world a better place, increasing the odds of us all winning the game of life. And now, here's your host, Dan Cates.
What's up, guys? It's Dan Cates, a.k.a. Jungle Man, and I'm here with a very famous guest from the poker world and beyond, Brian Rast, also known as Ryan Blast, also known as Ryan Raz in the right circles. For anyone who's ever razzed with him, he's won in tournaments $22.5 million alone, just in tournaments, and who knows how much money he's won in other stuff. It's not a small number, that's for sure. And he's probably succeeded at things beyond poker as well, is my guess, but you never know. Brian Rast, everybody, what do you have to say for yourself?
I first have to say thank you for that very kind introduction. Appreciate it, Jungle Man. Means a lot. And I'm just here to hang out and chat, brother. So, you know, what's the good news?
Well, I do want to mention I have razzed with you before, and let me say I thought I knew how to spell razz. I thought I knew like how to play razz, and then after playing razz with Ryan Razz, I just don't know what's going on anymore. I can't get my R words straight, and then you know like Oppenheim's in the picture, and David Oppenheim that is, and like you know some cards came out and I lost money and I'm just like, oh my god, I don't want to razz anymore. That's my experience playing razz with you.
So does that mean I play razz well or not? I'm not sure.
I would say so. I would bet that you're a better razz player than me, that much is for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's
probably a lot of people would say that.
Journey of the upcard games in Bobby's room has been like a really cool one. Cause I know like when I first started playing in Bobby's room, right. I'd say it was like 7 or 8 years ago, like the mix in Bobby's. Cause I had been playing, you know, when there'd be big PLO or no limit games in there, but like, you know, the mix with like Doyle and Ivy and, you know, Hennigan and all the guys that had already been in there forever, Jennifer Harmon. Like I came in as like a big bet specialist, basically. A few of the limit games I was decent to good in, like limit hold'em or something. I was like, okay, because I had played it before. But the upcard games were like the ones where I was just light years behind the people in that game. And especially like, I kind of thought out of, you know, stud high low and Raz was like the easiest to learn. But yeah, it's a cool journey because especially take like stud high. There's like people in that game who are just incredible stud high players. Like, I mean, you know, you just named Oppenheim, Hennigan. Well, yeah. I think they play great stud high, like amazing.
Probably do, so, yes, ring stud high specifically. But
so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe not heads up. You know, I don't know. I don't play that much heads up. You know, I'm not in the heads up streets like you. So, but yeah, ring. So, I mean, it was really cool, like learning those games, because over time it went from like, okay, I know those are my worst games and the ones I'm giving up the most in the mix, to now, you know, there's some lineups where I really like playing the upcard games. Like I like, you know, like there'll be certain lineups in like the Bobby's
room. Am I in those lineups?
I think guys who are like really great. I mean, I think there's people in the game now who oftentimes play the no limit and PLO just as good or better than me. but not necessarily the upcard games. You know, I don't really want to like name names, but yeah, I mean, I think you might qualify as one of those guys. So it's the journey. It's like the poker journey, like learning, you know, and seeing where you were and you know, where you are now, like training like Goku, you know?
Yeah. Well, the shirt's not that visible. Is it a Goku shirt or is it? Oh, it is a Goku shirt. How about that? Thank you for the shout out to Dragon Ball Z and, you know, the Dragon Balls and, you know. Gohan.
In memory of your 50K win, Jungle.
Thank you. We're going to get to your 50K win in a little bit also. It's a podcast about you, not about me. But I mean,
if I'm going to correct you, it's not my 50K win singular. It is my 50K wins.
Oh, yes. I actually wasn't sure about that myself. I looked it up. I saw one in 2016, but I don't know if there's like multiple or something. Thank you for correcting, because we're going to have to talk about a couple wins here. This podcast is about winning, so we'll be sure to mention all that. I do want to talk about the stud games a little bit, just because I don't know if anyone's going to know too much of what's going on, but you know, frankly, my opinion, because the stud games were like way less solved, and then as it turned out in the mixed games, at least, you know, the math seemed to suggest that people were doing things wrong a lot that people were sure about. So personally, I was suspicious of how good people actually were in the stud games. That being said, the way that those games, especially in Ring, work is that ranges are really pigeonholed in such a way that there isn't really that much leeway of stuff to do in shorthanded. That's not as true. So I can see how people would just be very good and still make fundamental mistakes in those games. One thing I want to add is that as an example of you know, people not really knowing really what they think they know. Once upon a time, a certain player, a certain old school player who doesn't do particularly well, I should say, was making fun of Sauce's play, Ben Solsky's play in stud, and said that he defended a hand with something like a 2 and 9-10 in the hole. This got me thinking, wait, maybe this actually makes sense. And then in that specific situation, it did make sense. And I thought, well, it looks like Ben is right and you're wrong, but I didn't say that. I actually did kind of say it, but it made me realize, you know, maybe these guys are as good as how they think they are. And then, you know, in that game, in studs, I can't really comment too much, especially as like not exactly the stud all-star myself, or Raz master. But in other games, I'm a little bit more confident about people's abilities or lack thereof.
Yeah, I also think, I mean, something that you alluded to early when in kind of introing into that is, you know, there's a difference between full ring and shorthanded play, like for sure. And I think when you're talking about the ranges being pigeonholed, I mean, I think, you know, people who are comfortable playing full ring ranges might be like pretty wildly wrong about what you're supposed to do when you play shorthanded, and those should be separated. And I think a lot of guys, like mixed players who play online, are going to play like in general, just a lot more shorthanded. You know, I barely play online, but when I have seen this online or whatever, there's a lot of like three-handed or heads up or whatever games, right? So I think guys playing decent mix online are playing a lot of shorthanded spots, whereas, you know, like most live mix games are 6 or 7 or 8-handed, right? So I mean, that's just fundamentally pretty different. It's going to be, but so, you know, you could almost, it's like almost both people could be right, you know, like, yeah, this is, you're supposed to play this. You know, it's true in all poker games in a sense, like the shorthanded spots versus, you know, how you play six-handed. And I know for me personally, kind of, I feel like my comfort zone is like five and six handed, where I feel like I tend to play the best. I know, you know, you're like a heads up master. And actually that's like the one area of poker where I really, like, I've kind of done almost everything in poker: tournaments, cash, no limit, PLO, mix. I've even done some like sit and goes and whatever. But the one thing I've never really grinded is heads up. Like, I've just never really played heads up poker. So
it's not that grindable. It's, you know, it's not really, I wouldn't necessarily suggest it these days. Also, it's not exactly the route to making a lot of money, especially with poker. Ring would be a lot better, or tournaments. Tournaments are still pretty good, I think. Once COVID releases its grip.
Oh, I feel like, you know, just me personally, it's already released the grip. I've given, for me, my own personal health and my situation, I've given two fucks about COVID for a while now. I mean, I got it in 2020. Mm-hmm. It was actually almost a relief, because after I got it, I was like way less worried about it. I got vaccinated last year, and for a long time now, I've been thinking, like, I even tweeted about this, finally, I finally broke the silence. I feel like the mask rule has been kind of a joke. It's almost like an intelligence test here. Some of these mask rules, like, for a while, it was like you'd walk into a restaurant, you had to wear a mask, then you take it off, but then you're like servers wearing a mask, but like most of the people aren't. It's so ridiculous.
It doesn't, but, like, and then you have to wear it in the gym, and like, what? Like, I was yelled at for like not wearing it on the treadmill once, and I'm just sitting there thinking, like, what am I supposed to how am I supposed to exercise and wear a mask at the same time? I mean, this is exactly the place that's supposed to be cleanly. It's not like,
And for me, like, with the recent Omicron is less deadly than the flu, this strain. Maybe in the future it'll be different.
Is that something Omicron after something about the Transformers? I don't know. Like, I feel like I've heard that word before. What is this Omicron? Is that like a Lego? I don't know.
Yeah, right. Omicron's what they're calling the recent strain of the COVID virus, like the recent mutation.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, right. The transform, like Optimus Omicron. But yeah, it's like, you know, we don't change our life every year for the flu. Now, I'm not saying like COVID maybe wasn't worse a year ago, it was more deadly or this, but, you know, it's like at some point, just go back. But, you know, I don't know if you know this, and I'm sure it's different in different places, but Nevada just axed the mask rule. So for the last like 2 weeks, no masks. Yeah. So it's like, wow. I feel like that finally caught on. Everybody's like, okay, we're done with this.
Okay, this is stupid now, guys. I was thinking the same thing about the flu myself. It's just like, you know, the flu kills people too, and people die of malaria a lot. What else? There's all these other crazy diseases. If you really do some research, it's like, why are we like freaking out over this one? At least at this point now, maybe before it made a lot of sense. By the way, there were people that wanted to catch COVID. They actually tried to catch COVID, to be honest, to be able to travel, at least when it first started coming out. And this is all ridiculous things for her. But yeah, it's good that this it's kind of like a global hysteria of sorts. It's not super crazy, but pretty crazy. I'm glad it's kind of over. Well, let's talk more about you. I know that you were a valedictorian, and you went to Stanford when you were growing up. Yeah, kind of a big deal. I've seen how hard it is to get into Stanford. I took a look at, you know, applying when I was going to school. I didn't have much of a shot. I was not valedictorian, as it turns out. But I would imagine that being valedictorian helps a lot, is a pretty good indicator that you're probably going to succeed in life, is my personal guess, because it's not easy to be valedictorian or get into Stanford. So I was pretty impressed with that personally. Any words to say now that any like what, like 20-year graduation speech, graduation words do you have to say as the former valedictorian?
Yeah, thoughts about that? Yeah, I mean, I can say that you know, my resume in high school was pretty, looking back, it was pretty awesome. It was impressive, you know, a valedictorian, 1550 SAT, 800 on my SAT twos. I, you know, went to like, did speech and debate. I went to the state championships for a couple of years, you know, just involved in some other things. I was like the captain of our school's quiz bowl team. We went to the county championships. You know, I just
impressive stuff.
I didn't get a single B in high school. I got all A's and I took like a bunch of college advanced placement courses. I was in a good groove at that, you know, something that I've learned over life at this point, now that I'm older and more experienced, and I went through my own, like in college, I wasn't motivated when I went to Stanford. A lot of it for people is just being in like the right situation. Like in high school, my parents didn't like make me do anything, but definitely encouraged it in a lot of good ways. And it's just all my friends were in classes with me, right? So it was like just a good spot where I was like motivated to do it. I had this idea, hey, I want to go to a good college. You know, I liked learning. I enjoyed it. When I went to Stanford, it was like, it wasn't like that there. You know, I wasn't motivated. First year, I just like played a bunch of video games. After that, I did do well for about a year and a half in school. And then it would, you know, then I found poker and it was kind of like, I was like, uh-oh. Well, hold on. This is fun. I love playing games. And now I can like make money playing this game. My other option is like getting this degree and like working for somebody. That sounds not so cool. So like once that kind of motivation fell off the wagon and I didn't have any drive for school, I mean, I didn't perform well. I mean, I didn't graduate Stanford and I ended up my last quarter there, I failed all my classes and I'm technically on academic probation for the second time. So, and I just didn't go back and you know, sorry, dad, because, you know, my parents. So, you know, I crushed it in high school. When I went to Stanford, that wasn't what happened. And it's just one of those things where you kind of learn, like there's a lot of intelligent people I've met, guys who, you know, maybe if they were in a situation when they were in high school and they were like motivated, would have done better than they did. So, you know, it's cool, but you also have to appreciate at the, you know, a lot of other factors that go into performing well. It's not always like, you know what I mean? It's just so simple. Like
I do.
That's
yeah.
What happens.
I do. But yeah, actually, I've learned to, I've kind of learned that subtly. I mean, I also understand a bit how I was motivated myself. Whereas peer groups wouldn't have been as motivating, but as I get older now, I can see like how like that there is some kind of term for this, is that your environment matters a lot more than your individual willpower in a lot of situations, or can be a really big factor, I should say. And if like a big part of your factor is like all these people like, you know, working in a positive way, you know, that can be quite helpful. I mean, it's still possible, I think, to overcome
sure.
those factors
no doubt.
Harder. You know, it's statistically going to be harder. There'll be less and less people. Maybe you're one of those people. I think you've got it in you. I believe in you, Ryan Raz, you've proven yourself over the years.
Ryan Raz, I got to tell. So the people at home for these nicknames, Ryan Raz is Jungle's like special nickname for me when we're playing like live and Raz comes up. But I've got to tell you, it's like every time Raz comes up, like half the time or something, I'll think about this nickname because and just like smile, because I just love Jungle gets all this like positive energy when Raz comes up and I'm at the table and he's just like going off about Brian Raz. So but it's only your name, the Brian Blast nickname. Who called me that? I think it might have been Andy Mosley. I think it was Andy Mosley, but I'm not sure. But it's from Macau, because back in the days in Macau, so you know we're talking like 10, 12 years ago, back in the pre-solver, like Uber Deep Stack.
I mean, those are the olden days.
Uber Deep Stack, Nova the Hold'em streets. And it's just like, you know, everybody in Macau knew that like once in a while, Brian Blast is going to just lay some fucking crazy hand over on people, like getting just like deep in the streets with stuff. But
didn't you know, like Kuro call me with ace nine in some like all in hand on the river or something. Like you like check raised me two streets and I shoved all in. And then you called me with ace nine. I think this happened and I lost.
Yeah, I think I was like bluffing you with like the back door.
I remember, yeah.
My guess is it was probably I had the ace and it was like two flush and I was like had, you know, like whatever, instead of actually having the nut flush draw blocker bluff with that. And then on the river, I just like decided to bluff catch witch up for whatever reason. I probably thought you were bluffing.
That was pretty funny now. I was only like losing $40,000. So I mean, who cares now? Well, I kind of care, but you know, yeah, that makes for a better story where if it was like $4.
Yeah, that's like a Brian Blast type hand. That's what I'm talking about.
That's what I want to hear about. That's what I want to hear about. Like these kinds of hands. Like no one's got the balls for that. People do kind of, but they need the solver to hold their hand and that kind of thing. I mean, that helps a bit for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the other things too that happens a lot, you know, I kind of think like, listen, solvers are awesome tools. Don't want to take anything away from it. And obviously, like if you're studying a solver and you're smart and you're extrapolating the right kind of, you know, information and like kind of little rules that you can take out, like, oh, this range restraint, this is what I do here, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're going to get better. It's the best tool we have to date. But I will say, and this is the but, it's like guys that learning today more exclusively on solvers, sure, you're going to like learn how to play GTO better. But like people that came up from, you know, quote unquote, my generation or whatever, pre-solvers, I'm 40 years old now. It's like the way you got really good was exploiting people. Like that's how, you know, I'm playing 400 big blind deep stack. The way that I really crushed it in EV was kind of like just figuring out live, you know, using a Bayesian analysis, kind of like what someone is probably doing wrong.
Brian.
Taking advantage of them.
Hold up for a second. I know what Bayesian analysis is, but why don't you explain it for the people here? We gotta communicate to everyone. We can't just use sciencey terms. And you know what? If I'm thinking about how to like explain that, I wouldn't like, you know, I'd have to think about it at the very least.
It's like a, you know, in this context, what it means is you're playing and you have, let's say every hand that goes by is some kind of limited amount of information and you're extrapolating sort of say the probability that this player plays in a certain way based on, you know, what is very clearly a small and insufficient sample size. And so like, what are the probabilities that, you know, this is true about how they play, like whatever their three bet frequency or something, given only 10 or 20 or 50 hands or something that you've played with them. It's pretty much, you know, what Bayesian analysis is. And obviously, you know, being able to do that well is like really important to like live poker settings where you're playing with like new players who you haven't played with before. So I mean, that type of, you know, I mean, that's all, you know, everything is a different skill set. And, you know, I'd say people from my generation, like being very good at Bayesian analysis with new players and then like quickly making the right adjustments and, you know, whatever. And the truth is, you know, okay, Brian Blass, but like I was winning a bunch of money. So I was, you know, I was doing something right. And the truth is there's times in Deep Stack Live back in the, you know, you're playing with people that are making mistakes. You could do some like kind of wild shit and it's kind of correct. You know, I'm not saying I always made the right play, but you know what? It's because at the end of the day, you're exploiting like sometimes huge leaks that people have in their games. And it ends up, and you know, sometimes if a kind of hand falls off and people see what happens, you're like, what the fuck did you just do there? But it's not like I'd say, oh, I'm going to do this against, you know, Jungle Man or Michael Thuritz, necessarily like world beater player all the time. But like, you know, this other guy, if after putting in a bunch of money, like checks the river, you know, maybe you just like pot it with this hand that I was floating that, you know, I wouldn't expect a good player to always just be so like face up when they give up or just, you know, any like weird thing like that. Right. So you can end up getting to places where, you know, with hands you wouldn't otherwise.
could you say that you could you say that you shouldn't be afraid to look stupid? If
of course not.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I can get on board with that. Sometimes I like looking stupid, so I can definitely get on board with looking that.
Yeah. Probably, you know, it depends. I'm not, it could be true today, but you know, in the like high stakes poker streets now, it's probably a little bit less stupid because, you know, guys are playing closer to game theory optimal. It's just going to be a lot less room to do the type of plays that I'm talking about. But yeah.
Well, you can always say it's a low frequency play, is what I've read. Mr. Falcons say. Anyway, Phil Gelfond.
By the way, I love your guys' videos that you guys made for, they were very entertaining, Jungle, that you made for the Run at Once.
Oh, I was being serious.
Like, the Jungle series. Yeah, they're funny.
Those weren't entertainment videos. Those were real.
If they
end up being entertaining, okay. I mean, like, this is, I'm gonna destroy this guy. It's not, you know, it's just what has to be done.
Sharpening your sword, walking around, thinking about how you're gonna, you know, wax people. It's fun to just like get in there and see what's happening with Jungle on the other side of the world, wherever you are in Africa, or where you're traveling around doing great things.
All right. I'll tell you where I'm at, because no one knows what the hell I'm up to. I'm in Istanbul, up to top secret plans, taking down Mr. Falcons is not even on the top of the list. Let's put it that way. But yeah, he's good in time. Let's put it up. Yeah.
I was in Istanbul last year. I went with my wife. We did about a month trip. We went to a wedding in London. And then after that, we went to Turkey, flew into Istanbul. We did like 16 days in Turkey. We started in Istanbul, took a bus and went on a tour, like down the Aegean, over around the coast, up, ended in Cappadocia and left. It was fun. Saw a lot of Turkey. Turkey's cool. Turkey's a cool country. We had a great time.
Yeah, I was about to say, I feel like Turkey and Brazil and Brazilian women, that combo seems like a winning combo of sorts, you know, like kind of like the turn check raise or the river check raise with a good hand kind of thing. But just in like the realm of life, would you agree? And can you extrapolate on this judgment, whatever you
listen,
want to call it, the assumption?
I went to Brazil 12 years ago and I left. I met my wife on my first trip. So
ROI.
Nothing but good things to say about Brazilian women, but most specifically my wife. I mean, you know, I married a Brazilian woman, so I'm clearly a big fan. Obviously, I know Brazil like way more than Turkey. I had this one trip to Turkey. Turkey was cool, but like, you know, I've spent who knows how many times I've been to Brazil now, 12 years. I mean, I own a place now, even more. I'm going to be going a little bit back and forth, especially mostly between Rio de Janeiro and the US. But like, you know, Brazil's a great country, like beyond just, oh, hey, like, you know, beautiful women, you know. The food is, I like Brazilian food a lot. You know, the weather is like really nice. There's a lot of cool like nature stuff in Brazil, hiking, like it's really green. It's lush. The beaches are awesome. Like the beaches in Rio de Janeiro pretty much crush, like definitely beaches in California. And to me, you know, I like Rio like way more than say like Miami personally. Rio is also like a super beautiful city.
Those are big words, by the way. Those are big words. Those are like what you just threw out there I don't know what to call it. That's like a big bet. That's like an over bet right there. It's like, yeah, I thought Miami was pretty nice. I'm not
take gonna a take Miami's good, no doubt. But I like being in Rio more than Miami for sure. I mean, you know, I also have a little bit advantage. I mean, I speak Portuguese, so it might not. Exactly.
I just learned Portuguese. Guys, I just casually learned Portuguese somehow. at some point. It's not exactly an easy language to learn. It's actually quite, because of the, it's difficult is what I think, because of the way that they speak it specifically in Brazil and all that.
That Brazilian Portuguese is a little different, but yeah. So yeah, I recommend for all, go to Brazil. It's great. I mean, Rio de Janeiro is like a gorgeous city also, just like the vistas of the city, because you have this like kind of metropolitan, but it's like set in a pretty like lush environment. So there's a lot of green, like right on the beach, but then also with some kind of like hilly mountains, like a lake, yeah. Like, and all of it kind of mixed. And so if you're in the right places, you're just like, get to feast on this like amazing view. And even it's like, oh, hey, and there's the Jesus statue up there too, or something. It just,
that's pretty cool.
The view, it's like Jesus. Really, it's like breathtaking kind of mix of like metropolitan rolling into the ocean, rolling into kind of like lush greenness. So, you know, it's got that vibrancy of life, you know, that kind of the green and the trees give, you know, not just like gray, monotonous
life, huh?
Stone. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's beautiful. I think it's one of the visually most beautiful cities, at least that I've been to for sure. Rio de Janeiro.
You're really selling me on this Brazil thing, man. And, you know, I'm like thinking about this whole Brazilian women thing, you know, with the, they got the, all right. So first of all, they've got you. And they've got a Jeff Gross too. That's a pretty good record. You know, I've had a little experience too. You know, they give massages and all that. And, you know, frankly, some women in some other parts of the world, more like westernized, how should I say this? They can be a little bit more difficult in the first place. Like, you need to pay attention to a lot of details, as I've learned, and like they can be causing all these problems. I don't know. You know, I'm starting to think maybe. I'm starting to think maybe there's something there.
Have you been?
I have not been to Brazil, but okay. I have been to Miami. And if you're telling me that it's better than Miami,
all
right.
With all your world traveling, you should go. And another thing that I'll say that's good about going right now, it probably won't change immediately. But, you know, who knows with the way the currency exchange rate is that like Brazil now for an American or, you know, is pretty cheap compared to at least historically. Like when I first went to Brazil, you know, 12 years ago, the real was like under 2 to 1 to the dollar. Mm-hmm. And in the last year, it's been like basically 5 to 5.5 to 1. So it's essentially the real is 3 times cheaper, you know, than it used to be. And, you know, it's not like everything just scales up. So it's not like everything costs 3 times more, you know, like things are just much like when I first went there, I thought, wow, okay, Rio de Janeiro is not like a cheap city, you know, like this is as expensive as going to like, you know, like pretty nice places like Europe, like maybe not as much as like, say, you know, downtown Manhattan, like the nicest places, but you know, it's not like I feel like, hey, I'm going to this Latin American country and like saving a bunch of money in Rio. But you know, now price wise, at least you kind of like have that feeling, like 5.5 to 1 with the real, like things are pretty cheap there for people coming in with dollars. So
that's pretty cheap.
Another thing that's, you know, it's nice when you're going there, you know, things are cheap.
Cheap.
Just saying. Nice.
Girls. Interesting. These are some good points.
That was one of the motivating factors for me buying my house last year as well. I'm like, okay, you know, between other things, I'm like, wow, exchange rate, like, look at what I'm getting. I'm just like, can it really get like a lot cheaper than this? I'm like, what I'm getting for this amount of money feels right. So whatever.
All right. Fair point. Maybe I'm going to have to investigate this Brazil situation.
Yeah. Check it out.
Run some Sims, you know.
See if it's GTO.
Yeah, maybe it is. I don't know. This is like sounding better and better. Holy shit. All right. Well, let's talk about some other stuff.
Let's fucking go.
All right. Would you say that your valedictorian skills or skills from school at all or skills from actually being successful at school translated to poker? Or do you think And or do you think that they're necessary to be successful in poker?
I mean, I would say that certainly some of the skills that, you know, made it so like I was able to be valedictorian that helped in poker, right? Like I've always been very, I've just had a very natural, intuitive strength or grasp of like math, let's say, right? So it's a lot of math stuff has come pretty natural to me. And it's not that poker, at least superficially, it's not that poker is that complicated with what you need to do with math. But even though the math itself, like, oh, hey, calculating this probability or whatever is like, you know, high school math of probability, it's like you can do that. That said,
yeah, I agree.
You are doing it in real time without a piece of paper, kind of like, and so as one of many things that you're kind of mentally running in parallel. So even if you can do it, if you have to sit there and use a lot of your mental energy just calculating the probabilities of the pots, you're kind of like wasting, you know, that's not like the most important thing that you should be doing mentally. So the fact that a lot of that stuff came pretty naturally, you know, that helps a lot with poker. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that kind of intelligence, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of different ways a person can be intelligent. And, you know, even the ones that are very specifically named, like let's call it the IQ, the number that the tests give, that are more like logic or like spatial reasoning or whatever, as opposed to like emotional intelligence, if you want to call it that. You know, I think so the more IQ based one that probably helped me do really well in school and whatever, definitely helps with poker, because poker has a lot of like logic based, probability based, you know, things running various thoughts in parallel. And yeah, so I mean that helped. Sure.
Okay. I feel like there's an element of poker that isn't exactly school smarts. And partly when I'm thinking of school smarts, to be honest, is like being a good student and being studious and working like consistently on stuff, because consistency is what's required.
Sure.
One of the things that's required to actually succeed at school.
I agree with you. When I was in high school, for example, a lot of the people who were in the classes I was in worked harder than I did. I'm not going to say I got all A's by not doing the work. I did the work, but like, I didn't study for tests. I just like showed up and took tests. Like I went to class, I did my homework, oftentimes with my friends who'd come over after school, we'd do homework together, play basketball, play video games, whatever. But like, I wasn't studying for tests, like me just doing it, stuff stuck in my brain. And it's one of those things where like, I like taking tests. I like being under pressure. It's almost one of the things that like translated to me doing well in poker as well. Like poker, you're kind of constantly under this like little time pressure to make decisions. And then obviously when the stakes get high or you're like late in a tournament, now you're under a lot of pressure because, you know, the stakes are a lot higher for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And I actually like that more. Like throughout my career, I feel like I've played some of my really best poker when the pressure's been high, because it's like one of those things where that just clears out all the noise and it's so easy to be in the moment. And like when you're in the moment in that flow state and like nothing outside of the table exists, like that's when you can like truly play your A game. Like for me, you know, people talk about, oh, what's A game? Like what most people refer to as A game poker, to me, that's B game poker. Like if I'm showing up and I'm not distracted, yeah, I'm not tilted really. Okay, that's B game poker. A game poker is nothing outside of this fucking, you know, 8x4 felt strip exists. And I am like watching hands and I'm picking up physical reads. I'm pre-adjusting, like, this is what this motherfucker thinks I'm going to do. So the next time this happens, I'm already like pre-adjusting for that and whatever. That's A game poker. It's hard to be in that state all the time, because it's like hyper focused, but yeah. And so, you know, I feel like I agree with what you're saying. And for most people, the way you do well in school was being like hyper disciplined. And I'm not going to pretend like, hey, I didn't do my work, but I also wasn't a person in high school who, you know, studied a bunch like, oh, I'm going to prepare for this test. Like me just like going to class every day and doing my work was preparing. And I just thought, great, take a test. Awesome. Like I'd rather take a test every day than have to do all this bullshit homework. Cause like homework sucked. Homework was annoying, but like I show up and take a test. It's worth a bunch on the grade and I'm done. Like, awesome. You know?
Yeah, so, homework was very annoying.
Yeah.
So. One thing I can certainly agree with is that I think that a lot of people do not apply themselves nearly as much, or at least if they do, they really hide it well, but it sure doesn't look like they do with being focused as much as you. I personally don't watch as many hands, but I do think about things such as pre-adjusting and like I have notes on players about certain hands and things like that. Whereas I feel as though, I mean, probably to be honest, to be really focused is really does give some kind of edge. I don't know how much I've disagreed with players a bit on this and I'm like notorious for doing so, but I have to admit it must give some kind of edge. I don't know what kind. It must sacrifice something. One odd thing that I found is that players, they don't pay close attention to details about how other people perceive them or how other people have played hands in certain ways, because there's really a lot of information there. At least if you play someone repetitively, it's a bit hard to extrapolate to, well, you can make guesses on populations and make guesses based off of like what people actually look like to make guesses based off of what people actually look like in order to make certain plays and all that. You can definitely do that. But in really competitive places, you need to, it's best to like really to pre-adjust and pay attention to the previous hands before like it's too late kind of thing.
Or even if, let's say you're focused the way I'm talking about, but you're not necessarily picking up super relevant reads every hand or whatever, because you're not going to. But oftentimes you don't even get to see which hand got showed down, right? So you can't pick up a read that's too crazy. You can still pick up things like, hey, is this guy who I play with pretty often or never played with or whatever anywhere on that stretch, like what state of mind is he in? How's he playing today?
Sure.
Is he playing the way he normally plays, or is there something different? Or, you know, I mean, there's just so many little things that like you pick up that if you're not really just like in there, this is all that exists, you're thinking about other shit, you miss this or that, or you're not analyze that specifically. And just there's something along all that where, because you're thinking about something else, you miss. And you don't do as well, or, you know, like, so that's just my feeling. But, you know, the flip side is, especially if you're playing poker a lot, it is hard to show up and just be like present. And that's all that exists, you know, hour after hour, the whole time. It can be tough. Right. But I will say being present like that is a really fun experience. So it's enjoyable. I mean, this is like why people meditate. It's why all this happens, because when you're kind of in that flow state and performing, it's cool. I enjoy it. So I, you know, it's fun to get in there.
I think definitely, especially in live poker, paying attention to the emotional states is very important, especially if people deviate a lot from that. I think it actually matters more personally with opponents that aren't are a little bit less theory based is what I would say, or more inexperienced personally, because then they can really change or not be aware of their state and that kind of thing. I mean, you can get specific reads of people based off their states if they do things exploitatively. Takes some effort, but yeah, I mean, that actually is one of the biggest differences between live and online, is that the people play differently in emotional states.
Sure. By the way, I agree with you. And let me give an example to back up exactly kind of what you're saying. So one of the things, like, I'm not sure if you're aware, but like this last WSOP that happened in the fall, like I played a bunch of WSOP tournaments. I actually didn't play a hand of cash poker, and I just played like 40 WSOP events.
All those tournaments.
Unlike the past where, you know, I would show up and like max late reg and usually only like 10Ks or above, kind of, you know, I played like the bracelet I won was the 3K six max no limit. I played some 1500s in some, you know, 1500 like dealer's choice and some ones that I'm like, I want to do this. When you're playing with, as you said, weaker players, people that aren't very good, I mean, there's a lot that you can pick up. Like, it was almost like a way back time machine in poker where I'm like, okay, these guys are doing shit that's like wildly bad that I can, you know, Bayesian analysis pick up within like 10, 20, 30 hands. And like, I should be changing my game like significantly to take advantage of some of this stuff. You know, like, here's a low hanging fruit type of example. You know, older guy in his 50s or 60s, rec player, no limit hold'em.
Rec means recreational guys.
Yeah. Folded to him in the small blind. He jams like, you know, 11 blinds, right? I'm deep. Like, okay, I don't know, I couldn't reproduce exactly the like shove call range here, but I like know it pretty well. Like what the shove call at GTO for like 10 or 11 or 12 big blind, you know, I'm like, you know, pretty good with that. That said, against this specific player who's very likely shoving like way tighter than GTO suggests, you should be calling like somewhat significantly differently. Like there's some hands in there that you like take off. So I end up, it was a guy who I actually had been talking to. I knew him through some, you know, friend, like knew him through someone else. And I ended up making like kind of a big fold. It was like, it might've been like King Deuce or King Three suited or something. That's like a clear call against a GTO, although not like crushing, but it's plus EV. Anyway, whatever. I mean, this is obviously super results oriented, but you know, I ended up finding out at the end of the day, when we talked a couple hands, like he had King Jack off or something, right? Which isn't surprised because, you know, I'm pretty sure this guy's not shoving stuff like, he's probably not shoving, you know, for 10 blinds, you're supposed to shove like any king offsuit. Like this dude's not doing that, you know, that's just not happening. He's not shoving, you know, some other, you know, like he's probably not shoving like the Jack six suited, right? Like, there's just, but these type of things happen all the time. And if you're in there thinking, making the little Bayesian reads on, okay, this guy, then all of a sudden, you know, you're playing some hands like wildly differently. And it's fun. Like it's fun to get back and play that kind of like exploitative poker where you get like these huge edges because you're making plays that are like significantly better than like the GTO baseline. So whatever. Anyway,
no, that makes a lot of sense. Enjoyable. Especially in tournaments. Yeah, it's just funny. Imagining you play like $3,000 tournaments and playing these like $300,000 buy-ins with like me and other people. It's a little bit different. You're like grinding out this, you know, this $1,500 edge or whatever you have. Like
it's not about the money when I'm doing it.
It's about the glory. Well,
about just the joy of playing the poker. Yeah. And the glory of winning the bracelet. It's about those. Sometimes actually it's been one of these things. So my poker in the last since then, cause I took my longest time off poker, really like not playing during COVID. Since I've come back, I did these weird WSOP events where I played 1500s. I even played 100K. You know, I played like the 50K. I've played some 10Ks since then or whatever. I've gone to the casino with friends and I played like $1-3 no limit hold'em with some friends, like drinking.
Well, it's different, you know, that's different.
Yeah.
Stuff like that too.
I played the 4 and 8K Marcus hybrid.
Just crazy the casual $1 million buy-in, like whatever, you know. But you know, sometimes there's a $3,000 tournament to hop in. You know?
I've just been approaching poker in these last months. Like I'm playing because like I feel like playing now and I'm enjoying it. And it's been refreshing, man. Like it's been because I kind of love poker. I love doing it. And I just felt like there was a period there where, say, prior to COVID, it was very much becoming like a job, you know, like, okay, I'm doing this to like win, and this is the EV. And listen, I'm a pro gambler. I'm always going to like winning. But that said, kind of taking the refreshing thing like, oh, I don't only need to do poker time in like huge spots for like big EV. Like I can also try to beat these guys in the 1-3 game, which by the way, I'll tell you, it's like the win rates in the 1-3 no limit game are fucking, I don't care how much they rate.
Really? No way.
Sky high. Yeah, bro.
No way. Like
these people play bad. They play bad.
Oh, they do?
They play bad, Jungle. It's fun.
No way. Come on.
Yeah.
The 1-3 game.
Yes. Yeah. People give off like the fucking most obvious retells and shit. Oh, it's fun though. You know, like it's fun, man. And plus when you're doing it too, you can kind of, you know, 5-6 drinks in, you know, like, you know, I'm not going to drink when I'm playing like, you know, the game with Marcus and the hybrid and all that.
I have a drink. Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't blame you. It's a little bit different stakes. 4K, 8K, 800, about $1 million buy-in. Yeah.
No, but it's like 200K.
The best players in the world.
It's like 200K buy-in, right?
4K, 4K, you can limit it. Excuse me. Okay, sorry. It's a little bit smaller. Sorry, guys. This is not $1 million buy-in. It's only 200K. Excuse me.
But I mean, from a different perspective, I really like that game. That I think of all the games I play from like an overall like kind of poker. Okay, like this is a test of like how well you know poker. That game that's developed, I call it the hybrid. And I've, you know, on my Twitter historically, I posted some pictures of all the plaques. I think that's like the most challenging game because like, you know, you played that game. It's like the mix will be between like 8 or 9 or like 13 or 14 games. And it'll be a wide mix of different limit and different big bet games. But unlike the normal like Bobby's Room mix or whatever online where the cap is like 40 blinds, which, you know, not that there isn't skill to 40 big blind cap, but there's a lot more that goes into 100, 120 big blind play. And like, for guys that are weak at big bet poker, it can skate by with knowing a little bit in 40 blinds. But when you get in the 120 blind streets and you don't know what you're doing, it gets a little scary. And so It's one of those things where in over 8 to 14 games, it's just like, you know, you've played the game. Like there'll be some game, it's hard to hide. It's hard to hide. And so it's one of those, it's like a fun poker game from that perspective to me, you know? So I enjoy that game a lot as well. I think it's intellectually challenging. And the way for me, poker's just things in life. Like I'm very intellectually curious. And so, you know, throughout my poker career, it's kind of been, I've always kind of, oh, this new game to learn or whatever. And, oh, I'll just try it. And my way of doing it is like kind of always jump into play. I've never been the type who's been like, oh, I'm going to learn this. So the first thing I'm going to do is go grind it like super small and study it to try to get good before I play big. It's more like, hey, let me jump in and try and take my luck.
That's Ryan Blast style. That's how you blast. You don't just like grind at the $1-3 with the veterans playing 1-3. You just hop in. Let's play.
No, I go play with the 1-3 guys. After I get good, then I go play with the guys for $1-3 to beat them up. But I don't start with them. Fuck that. No,
you got to send a message. You can't
start with the good people so that they can fuck you up.
You also got to defend your image in the 1-3 streets. You can't just, you know, go in there and play really bad and have them talking shit. That's no good. you got to respect your image whatever. Whatever. You have to, you got to do things the right way. Sounds like you got to figure it out.
Listen, about the 1-3, I don't want to say that I'm like showing up to the casino to play like 1-3 by myself. That is like, I'm with there's a Brazilian buddy of mine who fights in the UFC and he likes playing poker. And so, you know, a couple times we've been drinking and like, hey, let's play some cards. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I believe it. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you do show up and you just don't want to admit it. Who knows? I don't know. Probably not. But yeah, you never know. You never know.
I could be running a level two bluff right now.
So Birdie told me that you've won a couple bigger tournaments for the $50,000 tournaments, the Poker Players Championship. You know, allegedly, like it's a bit of a prestigious tournament to win, I hear. And maybe there's a little bit of money on the side too that suggested, you know, you might not be that good. And you may have proven people otherwise. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So this is the second one I won. I believe it was 2016.
It sounds about right.
The when I won it. So leading up that year to the tournament, you know, there's always like little, I think, time. So there's two side ways I got side bets down. I'm playing in Bobby's room in a mixed game. I believe like Matt Kirk and Timofey drafted teams for the 50K tournament. And I mean, I think I like Timofey's team more than Kirk's. And I'm like, so I talk with Kirk and I'm like, hey, Matt, and neither of them drafted me. And so I'm like, hey, you know, you didn't draft me, so you clearly think like all these guys are better than me. So, you know, how about I take me versus your team? And since they're better than me, like you lay me like 1.1 to 1 on each guy. So it was like 11 to 10% on each of his five guys. And he said, sure.
I'm a little disappointed in you. I want to interrupt that you only started 1.1 to 1. I mean, I think you could have got like 1.25 to 1 or something, honestly.
Maybe.
And no offense to you.
I probably would have fucking ran it at evens, to be honest.
Let me say this.
Bravado. Here's the truth is that, you know, some of these, there's a difference between playing online and playing live. And there's also a difference between playing cash and playing tournaments.
Sure.
And between the fact that this is a live and it's tournament, I just like really like my spot in the 50K and I'll fucking die on that hill. And in 2016, I think at this point now I had been kind of playing in Bobby's room for a little bit and I felt pretty good about holding my own with a lot of the players in mix. I thought my game had improved a lot over the last kind of year and a half playing in there. And, you know, even for example, on like Timex's site where he, you know, came out and he just like handicapped the entire field. And this is the other bet I got down. Most of the guys in Bobby's room. Well, listen, the top guys who did play in Bobby's room, right? Like Timofey and a few others are all like 1.5 or something. Right. And most guys, almost everyone else that played in Bobby's room was more than like 1.2. So I was like almost the lowest of anyone that played in Bobby's room at 1.2. And I'm just like not only
feeling that stand, you got to make it.
But I'm like, this is also a tournament. And unlike a lot of the players in Bobby's room, like I have a lot more tournament experience than them. So, you know, I mean, listen, not only is there a lot of ICM spots that matter in tournaments, but it's also like applying ICM to mix, which like most people have very little experience in, right? Like, I think there's some weird things. So I'm like, okay, so I'm going to bet myself. So I bet both. I bet Kirk and then I took the most Timex would let me take. I just kept this, and then he cut me off. So I ended up getting more than double on myself. Now some friends in particular, Antonio, who's, you know, I will say this, Antonio has been like one guy in my career that like, no matter what the fuck I'm doing, no matter what game I'm playing, no matter what I'm doing in anything, if I'm just like, hey, you want a piece? He's just like, yes. I don't even like need to fucking tell him what it is. So, you know, because of that, I give the guy pieces in good or spots that are a little dicey, right? You know, because that's what you earn. When you take the dicey spots, you get good ones. So anyway, he wants a piece of me in this tournament, but I told him and mostly him, but like maybe Jeff Gross wanted like a little taste or whatever. I'm like, guys, hey, I can't just like sell you face pieces of me in this tournament because I'm fucking like booking, essentially paying extra on the side. So you know, you can have a piece of these other bets. So even though I booked over double on me, I ended up only having like an extra, like, let's say 60 or 65% or something like that.
So, I mean, this is like on a tournament. So $100,000.
So then I ended up winning the tournament. You know, that one I got down and beat Bonomo heads up and won. And that was awesome because like not only did I win the 50K again, and it was cool because this time it wasn't no limit final table. It was the mixed final table, which actually was great the way it worked out because it ended up working out. I'm playing Bonomo heads up, where playing him no limit heads up would have been way tougher than playing, you know, the 8-game mix. So, you know, which is the opposite of when I won it in 2011 or 12 or whatever, when at that point in time, you know, I probably part of the reason why I played the tournament and it was huge that the final table, which was televised on ESPN, went to no limit hold'em, because at that point I was like a way weaker mixed game player, but you know, in the no limit streets, I was super strong. And you say whatever you want about Phil Hellmuth, I think I was the best no limit hold'em player at that final table. So, you know, like it just a big difference between those two times. And then I obviously had all this fucking extra money on the side. So I forget whatever first place was, but I won like a lot more than that for me and a few of my buddies. So yeah, that's what happened.
So I think we've got some morals for the story. First of all, bad lines such as rating you worse than all the Bobby Drew players in this tournament deserve to be punished, especially after you've already won the tournament. It seems to be a bit arrogant. And frankly, I personally think that the big bet matters quite a bit in these tournaments because you can have quite a large edge in the big bet. Whereas, I mean, I can see some potential big mistakes in Raz or whatever, but like maybe deep. And I just think that, I just find it hard to believe that all these mixed game players are playing these spots really well. I mean, maybe they're playing better than other people, but I mean, are they not going to punt a no limit? Like,
I think when you start going back like this long ago, I mean, some of these mixed game guys, especially with like smaller caps, they've improved their like no limit and PLO like decently in the last 5 years.
Sure.
But back in like 2016, some of these guys were horrific in no limit and PLO, and especially in spots like, you know, that tournament stays deep for a while. Like, I don't know. Don't you remember back in the day in the fucking Oppenheim, who plays a lot of the limit games, fucking world class, but like he would just fucking walk away like during like the PLO round. Like, I'll see you later. No ante. It used to be no ante. And it's the smallest blinds. So he just, you know, okay, I'm out. Like a bathroom break. Like, I'll see you guys in like 8 minutes.
This is not that crazy. I mean,
no, it's not
especially crazy. Especially if it's like so tempting to play too many hands. That's like really the right play would be to be very tight. I could see that. I presume it goes the other way also. I believe the second moral to the story is be bold. And when people are setting bad lines and saying, you know, it's some cocky things, you should go for the glory and punish. I think that's a lesson people could learn. Because I do think that probably on the whole, people do tend to be too, what's the word? To not take quite as many risks as they should.
Yeah, I mean, at that point in time, a 50K tournament now is not a big tournament for me. Like, so, you know, putting extra on a 50, it's like, not only is it a 50K, but at some point, I mean, listen, obviously my results have outperformed my skill winning two 50Ks. That's no one should in the world should win two 50Ks out of 10 years. You know, it's outperformance. That said, I still like, for me, I think the 50K overall is probably one of my, at this point, my hot, like maybe my highest EV tournament, right? I mean, it's like a very good structure. ranging from like deep stack at some points versus not, like all the games. Now we've added no limit single draw, you know, 9 games. So it's just one of those things where, yeah, I'm like willing to take, you know, I'm willing to take more risk on that tournament. And that's how I felt in 2016. And it was one of those things where sometimes in life it's good. You know, you probably have this feeling there's certain things where, okay, I could just show up and play the 50K, or, you know, I make this bet. I bet extra on myself. Okay. Now it's like, let's go. Like that day's like marked on the calendar. Like we're showing up from day one, going to be playing like the A poker game, like fucking ready to go. And it's like, prove to the world, like, yo guys, you know, let's do this. And now obviously I got lucky to win. It's not like just because I took it seriously, I'm not trying to imply that I believe that, but I do believe that starting from day one of that tournament, I tried to play every hand as well as I can. And I thought I played well, and the cards worked out. Whereas there are times where it might be true that for a 5-day tournament or whatever, there'll be like little lapses or this, or, you know, things happen and maybe I'm not necessarily playing my A game the whole time. But for that tournament, because of all of that, it's no, I showed up as early as I'm going to show up for a tournament. I think like mid level one or by level two, which I never do that, because grinding day ones of tournaments is just brutal. Like I can't do that.
When you've got the doubters out there, you've got a little extra incentive to play a little better. At least that's how I feel. Maybe even more so than the people. I don't know which is better. If you got believers, you got doubters, what about a little bit of both, you know? It's kind of a decent combo to get that kind of thing.
I feel like athletes have always been motivated by doubters. Like, look at any fucking sport, and it's like, if someone's like doubting or this or whatever, it just anyone competing and performing, usually it's like, okay, you think I can't do this? All right. No big deal. I'll fucking show you. Let's go. Right. I mean, there's something about that aspect of competition where, you know, you're already competing, but now you have this adversarial person or group of people out there who think you can't do it. So now it's like, okay, I think I can do it. And, you know, I'm going to show them. And I'm going to show me. I'm going to just show. And so now it's time to perform. Right. And then it's one thing to separate that feeling and then translate that to performing at your best. Right. Because the whole idea is sort of like, how can I get myself to perform at my best? And so it's how are you going to motivate yourself to do it? And I just feel like when you have doubters, it becomes a bit easier for most people to then, okay, I'm going to perform, because you would now have that reason, right? That you're going to show them. So, you know, it's the trick sort of peak performance is what it boils down to. Whatever. That's my analysis.
I will say that personally, I'm more, a lot more motivated if there's some doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite painful, frankly, if you're like on the grind and not necessarily succeeding. That's the problem with being too attached to it, is if you do fail, which happens, it's really painful.
Most of the time it's failure in poker. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Although what I personally experienced is it is quite painful. And then there's like this really, there's this like little pivot. It depends for other things, not just poker. There's this pivot where you feel really shitty. And then at some point you like come back. And then at least I personally think I try harder. I mean, that you may have the same feeling, but I personally think I'm particularly stubborn in this kind of way. Definitely in poker, it was true. In other things, it ended up being true. Some really nasty pivots, as it turns out. I kind of decided it's good to have some doubt, but not to be too attached to success in some kind of way, just because it can lead to some really nasty downturns.
Sure. No, 100%, man. I think the approach that you have to take is like this, like in this thing, okay, these guys doubt, I'm going to book this extra or whatever, but if I don't win the tournament, it's not like I'm going to be, oh wow, I agree with them, I'm no good. right? It's more just like, I'm going to show these fuckers, but then in the, you know, whatever.
No, that's when you double down. You're like, no, motherfucker. No, so we're going to run it again.
I'm blessed. I'm grateful. Thank you. Thank you, powers that be, God, Buddha, everyone, that in this moment, I got to say, I'm going to show these fuckers, and I showed them. But the truth is, it's got to be like, oh, hey, I lost that tournament. Like, what would probably happen? Okay, like, I'll just do it next year if I get to book at 1.2 and Matt Kirk lays.
You gotta talk more shit next year.
Yeah, like, fucking run it back, like, you know. So
all right, now I need 1.4 to one. 1.1.
Clearly, I'm trash. Okay, let's go. Right, so I, you know, you can't listen. The truth of gambling is, you always, you know, your confidence can't become arrogance, right? You do need to, like, try to accurately perceive how good people are, what your edge is, how well you're playing, how well they're playing, or whatever. I just felt at that point in time that I was being undervalued. Now, you know, I don't know what the actual appropriate, I'm not like a markup expert. Maybe it's possible that really everybody's markup was like too high on Timex's fucking site. Definitely possible. But given the relative markup situation, I felt that my markup bet was at least one of the best ones, and it's fun to bet on yourself. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like, maybe no one should be, you know, 1.5 for whatever, the guys he thought were best. Maybe, like, no one should pay that. It's just absurd. And my markup was just reasonable, you know, if I'm actually closer to being as good as them or whatever, you know? Anyway.
It's possible, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Related to, you know, this whole competition dynamic gives me some thought. All right. So you said other things besides poker have, or many things have piqued your curiosity. What else is there for Brian Rast besides poker?
I mean, so it's, you know, it's pretty public that I'm a Bitcoin bull. Right. I mean, really, starting in 2017, I started down the kind of crypto journey, and I spent a lot of time and energy learning and constantly, like, reformulating my views. And I have a very thought out belief about crypto in general. I mean, it's obviously a much bigger space than just Bitcoin, but, you know, I to very specifically in terms of investing for people, it's like, I think Bitcoin is a good investment. Mm-hmm. I think the rest of crypto is a much trickier investment. I mean, I feel like crypto as a space has just been blowing up. And to a certain extent, it's almost like this crypto casino where, you know, people hear about these outrageous true, but, like, kind of get rich. It's like somebody took, like, a very small amount of money and just made, like, you know, multi-millions type of thing. And everybody wants that. And I think at this point, like, most people who jump in there realize that Bitcoin's already kind of gotten big enough that, like, you buy Bitcoin today, you're not going to, like, 100x your money, right? Like, you know, 1000x your money or whatever. And so you technically what you'd have to do is go to the crypto casino and pick, like, some altcoin project that's small that ends up blowing up. Now, to me, the difficult thing about this is that it's very unclear to me that a lot of kind of, like, Web3 alt projects, first, you know, you're talking about a space where it's like all these ideas can be copied. So there's not, like, a big moat to any project, and there's going to be a lot of competition.
Yeah. Also, so not much barrier to entry, it sounds yes. like. I didn't even know that, by the way. I thought, you know, these projects were at least complicated enough that they can't just be reproduced easily. I mean, I'm not a crypto expert. I know some overlapping themes. I didn't know that. That's actually a big red flag for me as someone who's looking into a business. Like, one of the business questions to ask is, like, what's the barrier to entry for your competition?
Yeah.
I mean, and if then it's really low, then good luck.
Yeah. To me, another issue is that, so it's the whole crypto idea, like, something that sucks about, like, the traditional, like, investing market is there's all these barriers. Like, you have to be an accredited investor, and people just don't have opportunities to invest early in projects, which sucks for, like, you know, the 99% of people that are, like, aren't VC or, like, rich people with VC buddies or something. That said, The good thing about the way those projects work is early on in a project, some VC invests, they get a big fucking chunk of the pie, and they're investing some amount of money in a project that's not worth that much. The way the whole crypto investing things is like ass backwards, where somebody, these guys come out with like an idea that's going to take, you know, 5 to 10 years to implement. And they write a white paper, which is essentially just like a business plan. And all of a sudden that coin comes out and now everyone can buy it on like Binance. And all of a sudden this idea that hasn't been implemented now has, you know, is worth like $1 billion. And it's just like, okay, well, that's an idea that isn't doing anything right now. That's like worth some absurd valuation of like future potential. And that's just not the way like investing has worked anywhere else. So, you know, and I'll bring up a third issue, which is that while I do believe that decentralized blockchains will have a place for a lot of various applications, I also think that for a number of applications, they're costlier for a good reason. Like that's what you get from the decentralized, you know, nature of them. And for a lot of applications, like that costlier decentralized aspect, like isn't necessary and the market won't care. They'll be happy for some centralized service to do it faster and just trust them with the money or whatever for the project, which is, by the way, like things work today for the most part with Amazon and, you know, other products. So I just think like in all of crypto, there's a lot of good ideas and some stuff will shake out. But to me, it's like a very, given the valuations and how much money's pumping through all of it, I'm just like, you know, for the most part, fuck it. That said, to me, Bitcoin, like that's a awesome application, like being a, you know, a decentralized monetary asset that's not controlled by any government. Like that's an awesome fucking application. And Bitcoin has a big moat. You know, like the only thing that's even like potentially going to compete with Bitcoin is kind of Ethereum. So if you want to have Bitcoin and Ethereum, great, you know, but Ethereum's also kind of trying to do a lot other things too, as like a, you know, dApp protocol, this and that. So whatever. I mean, I'm very short summing up my kind of crypto investment thesis, but it's kind of like, hey, buy Bitcoin. And you know what? Don't be disappointed with like a 5 to 10x, because by the way, in like any other place in the world, that's a fucking great return on your investment.
Yeah, how disappointed could you be for your 5 to 10x? Come on.
Like today you buy Bitcoin at 40K. Man. At 40K. And I think it's like completely reasonable that within the next 10 years, Bitcoin, like who knows, like 50% chance or something like that, Bitcoin will be $500,000. So you're talking like a 10x essentially. Like, so, you know, like, okay, yeah, you're not going to take 1,000 and become a millionaire anymore on Bitcoin. But like in terms of like, hey, let me put money on what's still a more risky investment than, you know, say like buying real estate or something. But like the return potential is still like huge. And Bitcoin's like never been a safer bet. Like if you bought Bitcoin when I bought it in 2017 or 18 or 19, right? It's kind of like, okay, yeah, you're buying it for 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, even 10,000 or whatever. Like, you know, there were still a lot of questions of like, how is the US going to treat this from a regulation standpoint? And is the network going to really like continue to grow? If like, you know, like one of the things about Bitcoin is like when shit starts hitting the fan and people are selling and Bitcoin drops from 20,000 down to 3,000, will the buyers of last resort step in, or will the price just keep on plummeting and, you know, will it fall out? And it's like, yet again, we saw that it happened in 2019 when 6,000 broke and it broke down to 3,000. People stepped in and bought and just, you know, Bitcoin survived. Like yet again, another huge drawdown like that. So, you know, I just think to me, Bitcoin is, let's call it the safest investment by far in the space. And to me, that's like worth a lot. Like if you want to think about things from like a Kelly criterion kind of aspect of like, how should I invest? You know, Kelly will say, especially for investments with like big returns, you should strongly prefer something that is a safer investment. I even did this tweet thread from who knows, sometime in the last year, which I essentially like broke this down using a Kelly criterion calculator. So, you know, I just think Bitcoin and possibly Ethereum really are just, that's it. So unless you're like part-time crypto investing, you know, investigating projects, doing a shitload of research and trying to figure out like how to invest. In other words, you're like a very small group of people. If you're just like everyone else who wants to put some money into crypto and just kind of forget about it, great. Buy Bitcoin and Ethereum and just fucking walk away. Don't look at the price go up and down every day. Check back in 5 years and see how the price did. And if your 10,000 is now worth 50 or 100, awesome. Now think about buying a house with it or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like that's how most people should approach a crypto investment, which, but that's not what most people are doing. They're hopping on, you know, so like.
Well, they're doing this gambling thing. They're like trying to strike it rich. Sorry, guys, it's going to be really tough to make $1 million from crypto unless you're very lucky.
No, but you want to make a million? Huh? Put 100,000 in Bitcoin and check back in 5 to 10 years. Yeah, maybe you make a million now, but not with $1,000 anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like, but you know.
But sorry, guys, you can't make a billion off $1,000. All right. Well, whatever. Yeah, I think it's. I think you can't really go too wrong with Bitcoin or Ethereum. Also, I personally think decided to for this kind of thing to either be like really an expert or just take the really simple route and get Bitcoin and Ethereum and get like. I mean, I personally think something like 80% of the value, as you said, my personal understanding is a lot of this crypto stuff, unless you like really know what you're doing, you're not going to make any money. Or if you like find a way to arbitrage, but I understand that's over.
Trading is a tough game. And the thing about trading, so in poker, you're like, you know who you're at the table with. And you could be at a poker table with the best players in the world, in which case you need to be one of the best players in the world. Or you could be at a poker game with some amateurs and some guys who aren't that good. And you can beat that even if you're not one of the best players in the world. When you're trading, you're always at the table with the best players in the world because you're at the market. And so it's a tough game. And obviously, you know, for the most part, poker does scales very poorly. You know, at some point from like $100 buying games, the $1,000 buying games, maybe even a $10,000 buying games. It's very easy to go to casinos and this and find it and are online and scale up. But once you start getting in games where you're buying in for more than 10K, it can be start to become very difficult to find action. So, you know, like if you're trying to, hey, like I have a, you know, $15 million net worth or bankroll or whatever, and I want to like try to play poker to make a couple million a year, that could just be a tough proposition to like find the right kind of action for you. Whereas, you know, trading fucking scales up huge. Like there's guys who could make, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars a year trading because, you know, you can trade as big as the market and, you know, crypto and especially even traditional markets as like, think about how much money is in equities or even like how much Bitcoin is worth.
Yeah. But don't you have to be the best in the world? And don't you have to like,
yes,
like, you do. Be like super, super on point and like have the right models,
information flow, like getting all the like, right, like,
you know, warehouse full of computers. Or, this is what I think I'd be with if I was to trade or think this is what I think you'd be up against. You know,
so I've dabbled in trading and I've had my ups and downs. And, you know, it's one of those things where I feel like if I, you know, maybe if I were to really, really dedicate myself to it and up my game, you know, I feel like I could beat it. But, you know, short of myself doing that, you know, it's something I'm going to treat with a lot of respect because it's very difficult. So, you know, for now, I'm mostly going to just sit back. I think the next year plus of the market will potentially be very difficult to trade. Because right now we see a situation where crypto is, because a lot of big money has come in, crypto is very correlated to a lot of, you know, other financial products like the S&P and whatever. And, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, there's war in Russia and Ukraine. How's that going to play out? You know, we just had a 14-year secular bull market with all this monetary expansion. Is the Fed's going to cut back? It's going to taper. You know, the stock market is, you know, how's it going to perform? You know, for the next year or two, if the stock market is a bit choppy, crypto could be too. But crypto, unlike the stock market, is, in my opinion, like a growing network, right? like still a very small minority of the world ultimately like use and own Bitcoin and crypto, but that's growing. Like El Salvador, national currency. Like what if other countries start doing that? What if a spot ETF is approved? In other words, there's some like exogenous bullish events which could cause like the correlation to uncouple to the upside and Bitcoin to like have its next price movement up. But it's very hard to predict these things ahead of time. Like you just don't know like when the next country is going to, hey, declare it legal currency or, you know, something like that. So, you know, I just think it's going to be a tough market to trade, and sans, you know, having like the ultimate information flow and being in there and being one of the best in the world. You know, I would strongly recommend for people to be like very careful jumping on to exchanges and doing all that. And just to treat crypto like, hey, I'm going to buy this Bitcoin and ETH, buy a little bit here and there, especially when the price dips, lock it away either on this exchange or in my cold storage and forget about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this is one of these things where you really can't go in half-hearted. You have to know your foe. This is what me and my friend used to say about poker, is know your foe. And probably like really be serious if you're trying to make money. That's what it sounds like what you're saying. And this is what I'd imagine be the case, is to dedicate your life to this, participate with the best in the world. What was I going to say? Oh, it's kind of a funny thought to imagine like the Bank of El Salvador owning some Bitcoin. Salvador is getting in on it too.
nation states are like the final bidder. The final bid will be when countries start holding it as a reserve currency. Countries which can print fiat money to buy an asset which can the supply cannot expand. Hello. I'm just saying, like, I mean, that end game. Yeah. I mean, like people throwing out, 500,000 Bitcoin. Like, it's like people, that's part of how you get that. And like, by the way, 500,000, it's almost like the lower bound, in my opinion, if like stuff like that starts. So, cause I mean, you still have all the natural adoption that can take place at this point from, you know, actors, funds, you know, private individuals and whatever, companies at some point even. And that's like, you know, then you can add on, you know, states including it. And we're already looking at a world today where, based on what's happening with Russia, it's very clear that Russia has been planning for some time to like wean itself off the dollar. The US has been becoming weaker. It's just a fact. Like if you look at the US internationally after the USSR fell like 20 years ago, 30 years ago versus today, it's a little weaker internationally. And I feel like Russia and China are, you know, would like to wean off the dollar just being like the most dominant currency. And one of the potential things that can replace it, you know, is Bitcoin. And to a certain extent, Bitcoin is almost like more GTO than something else, because, okay, what would China like to do? China would like to replace the dollar with the yuan, but like that would be a way bigger problem for, let's say, other countries and especially the US than replacing the dollar with Bitcoin, because at least Bitcoin nobody controls, whereas, you know, the yuan would be like replacing what the US controls directly with what another country controls. You know what I'm saying? So there's a bit of almost to me like GTO-ness about at least like Bitcoin is a currency that's basically not controlled by anyone, as opposed to like by someone. So as, you know, some actors like Russia and China probably wean themselves off dollars, because to be honest, they want to do shit like invade other countries. In this case, you know, the former USSR, that countries that split off, or in China's case, like, you know, Taiwan, like there's always going to be that question of like, what are they going to do about Taiwan? And when they do something, like, what is the world going to do about it? But, I feel like Bitcoin is something that's always potentially going to be it. And so, yeah, El Salvador is this like tiny country that doesn't have that much money, but you know, what if other tiny countries start doing it for whatever reasons they have? And then what if the first big country starts doing it? And, you know, we'll see. We'll see.
All right. Well, this kind of leads up to the next thing I want to talk about. I do think that Bitcoin is a step in the right direction in the global scale of things towards the world becoming more how should I say? I want to say egalitarian and more of more. I think egalitarian is the right word. Just more of a fair place, because I think it's actually really quite a long process. And if you look at like the course of evolution, the course of human history, it appears, at least from my perspective, that you could say that there's been some books on the subject that humanity's distribution of power has become less and less polarized, if you know what I mean. Like at some point there were these chieftains states, and like the chiefs had all this power. They actually could not, as it turned out, the chiefs actually could not exploit people up to a certain point or beyond a certain point, but they still had like infinite power if you were the chief. And then at some point there were like these feudal states, and then there's like the beginning of like a little bit of rights for people. Then at some point, you know, feudal states are monarchies, and at some point like republics came into existence, and now you've got the beginnings of decentralized currency. I'm not like an expert really on any of these subjects, but I believe you got some beliefs about these sorts of areas, this sort of direction of the world. Is this something that let's just pull it out there. Is this something that you still think about or still care or do care about, period, or have any thoughts about?
Sure, man. I mean, so I know that you saw that I wrote this because you asked me about it, but I wrote this article that's on my blog. If you just type like Brian Rass, Citizen of Earth. So something I wrote, when did I write it? Looks like, I'm not sure, some years ago. And it's kind of about this idea where, at today we really think of ourselves as citizens of these countries. And to me, this is sort of about what you're talking about. I'm not answering every question directly and we can hop back maybe, but just about this idea, like, you know, I think during the course and like the evolution of human history and civilization, clearly like nationalized governments and nation states played an important part in our growth. But I feel like today it's almost like the nation state solution in the world has outgrown its usefulness. And it's almost like a prisoner's dilemma where like the way that nation states operate competing with each other is leading humanity to a suboptimal solution, right? Like the optimal wave, like the prisoner's dilemma is a game theory dilemma where, you know, the individual actors doing what's GTO for them, right? Like the best solution actually leads to a suboptimal state. So like, what do I mean by this specifically? For example, all of our countries all have their little military budgets, especially the US. How much fucking money do we spend on military? It's like, why? Like, I guess because stuff like what's happening with Russia and whatever, but like the truth is that if we were able to develop more of like, hey, we're all citizens on Earth and agree to like some kind of more structured government, you know, we wouldn't all need to waste. Maybe there wouldn't be as much war. That's a more thorny issue, but something that I'll say is, I think much clearer in this regard is like, let's say we're all of our countries are motivated for economic expansion. And oftentimes say like economic growth comes at like a very high environmental cost, right? Talk about like the type of energy you're using. Like right now it costs a little bit more to move towards clean energy, but we could clearly do it if we were motivated to like spend a little bit more money, right? About the way waste, like the plastic dump in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the deforestation, like in Brazil, they're cutting down the Amazon tropical rainforest, like the lungs of the earth, like something from biodiversity and all these things that's like this amazing that can't just be replaced in order to build like soybean farms. Like to me, this is like humanity at its most insane if you think about things from a global perspective, but not from the perspective of like farmers in Brazil who want to make some money, right?
Yeah.
So well, it's like I feel... So I feel like it's like we almost need to start zooming out and say like, yo, we're citizens of Earth. We exist together. Like my brother in Turkey, my brother in, you know, Afghanistan, my brother in France, it's like they're all human beings. Like who really gives a fuck like that they were born outside of the US? It doesn't make them like less or, you know, more important or anything. Like there's a lot of problems that are going to be coming up that need to be resolved by like us working together. And this like prisoner's dilemma of suboptimal solutions that happen because we're like so fixated on our nation states and competing on the small level, which like ultimately does nothing for us as a species, especially when you start looking at like expanding out into space, maybe dealing with potential like extinction level events like asteroids one day, you know, environmental concerns and just like all these things. So, you know, I feel like that's part of the next evolution. And I actually do feel like decentralized monetary solutions like Bitcoin actually will help guide humanity towards these like better paths. But yeah, so I mean, that's like me encapsulating a little bit of this. And you should check out my article I wrote some years ago because it kind of talks about, you know, some of these thoughts as well. But yeah.
Well, I'm happy to link to your article. It sounds like what you're saying is that essentially humanity is becoming, or the earth is, the city states are essentially acting as agents of, in the prisoner dilemma on a grand scale. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do have one specific thing related to that I want to ask you about. But I also want to point out that this dynamic that you're talking about doesn't just exist within the city states. It exists within, you know, it almost looks like this exists. Well, first of all, it exists for the beauty standards of women, by the way, because, you know, like the filters on Instagram are essentially driving the beauty standards higher and higher. And this is like having like some really adverse effects on women's like mental health, for example. And it's just like forcing people to look really, really, really good, or else, you know, they don't get the guy they want or whatever. I mean, I personally suspect it also is having some really drastic effects on the sexual economy on the whole, and causing a lot of stress for both sexes. But it's hard to say, but definitely there's a lot of stress on both sexes in the first world nations, and like the US, for example. That has been... That is shown a bit from data. There's lots of, you know, over 50% of women, like, I forget the exact age range, but over 50% of women, like, below the age of 30 or something, are now, you know, have some sort of mental illness, diagnosed mental illness. That's pretty insane.
What percent of women under 30?
I don't know if it's under 30. I don't know the exact range, but it's something like over half. I need to find the exact age range, but it was for over half of the women in the U.S. are, you know, have some kind of mental illness, and there's various factors pushing that direction. One interesting thing I've noticed is that between the ages of 18 to 30 years old, about 27% of men are virgins or have not like gotten laid in this age period, which to me seems really crazy, but like it seems really crazy, but also I can definitely see how this is happening just because of this like hyper like need to like, you know, just because of like what Instagram is doing to sexualization, but not just what Instagram is doing to like about the standards of, or what the perceived standards are, not just Instagram, but like social media and whatever else is doing about the perceived standards are of like what you need to get laid. And, you know, now there's less and less relationships because there's so many options and all that. I mean, I personally guess that it's related. And then it's not just in that field. It's, as you said, it's also in the fields of agriculture. Let's see, what are some other fields? There's actually an article that Liv Bowery showed me, writing about all of this, but it's in many competitive fields that where, you know, if people sacrifice their values more and more for the sake of profit, essentially it ends up being worse and worse for everyone, unless there's sort of some kind of global global coordination, if you know what I mean. I'm trying to think of what are some other examples. What are some other examples? I would presume anything that like results in being bad for the environment, any business that if people are too competitive will end up being bad for the environment, which obviously will be bad for everyone. I'll have to find the examples. But anyway, yeah, it just seems like this dynamic is becoming more and more important to recognize, and that it's like not exactly slowing down. It's maybe even speeding up. So it seems as though some sort of events should take place or may take place that will necessitate the global coordination of humanity in some kind of way. As you said, like, you know, us recognizing that we're, you know, essentially one nation.
You know, something you touched on earlier. I mean, you know, we'll see, like, well, what Russia's doing, coordinated a little bit, will it get our heads out of the sand and be like, what will happen out of this? I don't know. I mean, you mentioned that something along the lines of before, how it, like previously, or the polarization of power, you know, I don't know whether or not that's true. Like, we'll see how things play out, but there is a case today where there are some countries in the world where, you know, let's say Russia and China being pretty good examples, where it seems looking in from the outside that, you know, power has been centralized in really the hands of, like, you know, Putin and Xi Jinping. I'm not like a geopolitical foreign policy expert. Like, they basically run the country as dictators, especially Putin, maybe more than Xi Jinping. I don't know, you know, to what extent that is precisely true. But, you know, given the ability today with like the internet and certain controls on information, you know, and the power that like the military has, like, and military weapons have compared to things historically, I mean, it definitely to me opens up, you know, some dystopian type futures where, you know, it's capable for like an extreme polarization of, say, like a dictator or someone to, you know, run a country or whatever, maybe to a level not similar to the past, but, you know, it seemed like the trajectory of humanity was like moving away from that, right? Like, oh, hey, like, you know, we're democratizing countries around the world, but, you know, here are two, especially China becoming one of the most powerful countries in the world, you know, arguably basically one of the two today for sure, you know, and China doesn't really operate that way. You know, Russia's not nearly as powerful as it used to be, especially economically, although it does have a lot of nukes. But so, yeah, I don't know, like, there's a lot of ways all this can play out. I tend to be relatively optimistic, but, you know, who knows, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to predict what will actually happen. And I can see, yeah, when you think about it like that, there are, it seems like you can create arguments in both directions. I'm actually really curious to, like, if I knew how to research this thoroughly, I'd be really curious, although it's at this point, one issue with this stuff is it's like so big. It's like, what can you really do? How practical is it really to your real life? It's really hard to find a definitive answer as well. For what it's worth, by the way, there's some kind of, you know, some sort of, I believe there's like considerable evidence that the Chinese market could face some sort of crash in the future. Usually these systems that are run fear-based seem to have a lot of, you know, really long run downside, because, you know, it's really hard to control everything through fear. But again, I'm not like a massive expert on, you know, political policies or anything. But in order to make that work, you need to like basically control things at all times, which is really impractical. That being said, you know,
so, hey,
there's some real extreme cases that can come up, especially with the, you know, the internet and how globalized the world has become. Huh?
I've been enjoying this conversation a lot, and I would normally just keep going with you. That said, my contractor for my house that's in the middle of like the longest remodel project of all time is here. And he's been waiting for me for 20 minutes at this point.
Oh, I had no idea. Okay.
But I've continued, but at this point I feel like I need to not let him wait any longer and go in and deal with all my fun real life problems and
okay.
And sidestep. I've really enjoyed this. I wish I could keep going. I will say for those out there that I don't know what is going on, but like I think today in the last 24 hours, Bitcoin has printed an enormous green fucking candle and it's gone up from like 38,000 to like, it's almost 44,000 right now. I don't know.
What's you do that, on. Brian?
It's mooning. It's mooning. All right. I came on Jungle's podcast. I started talking about Bitcoin and everybody went out there and bought it. Good job, all right. Guys.
All right. Well, I was going to ask you another question about Bitcoin and the direction the world's going, but I'll just leave it with this. What's in the future for Brian Rast? Are you going to help bring the world, let the world see that, you know, actually we should all work together and become, you know, act as though we're all citizens of the earth? What's in the future for Brian Rast?
Man, the future for me, you know, I'm not really sure. I'm going to probably I'll play some poker. I'll probably continue being a bull on Bitcoin. I'm probably going to do some more poker commentary. I am going to, you know, I'm going to be back and forth from Brazil and the US, spending time with my family down there. And, you know, I mean, helping out a lot of people in my family in Brazil, you know, a lot of the cool thing, you know, a lot of what I do in poker at this point, you know, I've been, you know, we're down there and, you know, helping out people in my wife's family and stuff. And it's been really cool. And, you know, like, I just feel, you know, I'm going to keep definitely sharing my ideas as I go. And as, you know, opportunities maybe present themselves to do more, I'm always going to stay open to try to spread like kind of love and like the right ideas around the world as possible. And so, you know, thanks for giving me an opportunity to do that here. And hopefully all it takes is changing a mind, right? That's how it happens, is like people's minds change. And eventually like that has an effect on how people express themselves. But
that is a hope. Yeah. I'm in the business of changing minds now, by the way. And sounds like a great plan, Brian Rast. Sounds like you've got a bright future ahead of yourself. And hopefully you can spark a little bit of that.
Thank you, Daniel Cates. Thank you, Daniel Cates.
Keep blasting. All right. Well, good luck with real life and all that.
Thank you, brother. It's been fun. And, you know, maybe another time soon, okay?
All right, sure.
Peace.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Winning the Game of Life. Tune in next week for another great episode. Of course, hit subscribe and follow Dan on Instagram at TheDanCates.